Today Then is, and always will be, available for free. But we'd love for you to subscribe on iTunes, and if you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review.
This is John Philip Sousa, and I'm very glad to be here with my band, representing my own country, America, on this international program.
Hello, and welcome to Today Then, a podcast about today, then. We're your hosts, Molly,
Steve,
and Eitan. Every month on the last Tuesday of the month, we take an event that happened on that date in history and give you the deep backstory. Also, be sure to check out our newest feature, Briefly, by Today Then, released every Tuesday.
Now, before we dive into this month's episode, we'd like to say how honored and excited we are to be nominated for the Best Local Podcast in Rochester City Newspaper's 2017 Best Of list.
When we started producing Today Then at the beginning of this year, we set out to tell compelling stories from throughout history and from wherever history is made. But our love of history is fueled, in a lot of ways, by the place where we produce this show, Rochester, New York. This is a city that loves exploring and celebrating its rich history.
It's the home of George Eastman and Kodak, of Susan B. Anthony, of Frederick Douglass, of Cab Calloway and Son House. It's a place where history is a part of everyday conversation, and a place where we've found a lot of amazing experts to interview for our episodes, whether it's librarians and professors at the University of Rochester or the head of the local Baseball Umpires Association.
So check out the pinned post on our Facebook page and vote for us for Best Local Podcast. Thanks.
All right, on with the show. As is our tradition, here are a few events that happened on this date, September 26th. In 1789, Thomas Jefferson was appointed the first United States Secretary of State, John Jay the first Chief Justice, Samuel Osgood the first Postmaster General, and Edmund Randolph the first Attorney General. In 1960, the first televised presidential debate took place between Richard Milhouse Nixon and John Francis Kennedy.
Francis is your middle name, Fitzgerald.
Yes.
Oh.
Damn it. You're projecting.
I'm projecting.
Damn it. Sorry.
It's totally understandable.
For a second, I was like, wait, you guys have the same middle name.
Yeah. I gotta do that again.
Sorry.
I knew that. In 1960, the first televised presidential debate took place between Richard Milhouse Nixon and John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
In 1986, Run-DMC became the first rap group to hit top 10 with their album Raising Hell. In 1990, the Motion Picture Association of America created the new NC-17 rating.
And on September 26th, 1892, a young composer and conductor named John Philip Sousa took a train from Washington, D.C. to Plainfield, New Jersey. America's March King was about to embark on a new path and direct his own private ensemble for the first time, and change the history of music in the process. We'll begin after the break.
John Philip Sousa was born November 6, 1854.
Hey, that's the same day I was born, 133 years later.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In Washington, D.C.
Hey, that's the same city where I was born 133 years later.
Okay. Well, Sousa was the third of 10 children in a musical household.
Okay, he's got me beat. I only have one sister.
By the time he was 13, he'd studied voice, violin, piano, flute, cornet, baritone horn, trombone, and alto horn. John Philip's father encouraged him to play in the U.S. Marine Band, mainly so he wouldn't run off to join a circus band. He rose up the ranks, and in 1880, Sousa became the conductor of the U.S. Marine Band. In fact, the first American-born conductor of the ensemble.
He directed the band under five presidents: Hayes, Garfield, Arthur, Cleveland, and Harrison. For President Garfield, Sousa composed an inauguration march. And for Garfield's funeral 6 months later, he composed In Memoriam. During During this time, Sousa also composed The Washington Post as fanfare for an essay contest his fledgling hometown newspaper was hosting. And Semper Fidelis, written at President Arthur's request for a new song for the president, since he didn't really enjoy Hail to the Chief.
Clearly, Sousa had musical skill and the knack for being a showman and entertainer, which we'll get to a little bit later on. But it's not generally the fate of a U.S. Marine Band director to become a household name. Like, how many U.S. Marine Band directors can you name?
What about Taylor Branson?
Or Jack T. Klein?
Dale L. Harpone?
Francesco Fanciulli?
Venerando Polizzi?
John R. Bourgeois?
Raphael Trier?
Timothy W. Foley?
Ooh, but what about John and Joseph Cuvillier?
Or William H. and William F. Santelman?
Okay, well, it's not typical for a Marine Band conductor to almost completely redefine American popular music.
How about the current guy, Jason?
Put simply, Sousa's success was in many ways a case of right place, right time.
The period in which Sousa was coming to prominence, the end of the 19th century, the era between the Civil War and World War I, this was a time when the way the masses consumed music was beginning to change. Before the Civil War, Americans experienced music mainly in the home or at church. The big concert, as a mass social gathering the way we think of it today, wasn't really a thing yet. In a lot of American homes, families would perform music together or for each other, providing entertainment late into the night.
Families made music for themselves.
This is Jim Davis, professor of musicology at the State University of New York at Fredonia, who is an expert in 19th century American music.
The daughter would play the piano while everyone else was sitting in the parlor. The son would join the daughter and he would sing a song. Mom and dad might sing a duet for brother and father. Or the whole family would join in. It was not uncommon for a family. One person was a pianist, one person might play the violin.
But as the Civil War began, a lot of the men from these homes joined the military and ended up forming brass bands that would travel with the regiment. Military bands entertained soldiers in the evenings and provided music to march to during the day. Sometimes, Union and Confederate soldiers would be so close, they could hear each other's bands, and a game of who's best would ensue.
It was not uncommon for, let's say, a Union band to come up close to the lines and start performing. And after a particularly nice piece, Union and Rebel pickets applauding, and then the Rebels shouting out requests for songs, which the Union band would promptly do. And perhaps then the most fun is when a Union and a Confederate band might be stationed near the front. There literally are a handful of accounts where you had a little battle of the band, that the Confederate band would play a song, both sides would applaud or cheer, then a Union band would play, both sides would cheer, and this would go back and forth, usually until somebody played Dixie or Yankee Doodle, and then the opponents would groan and boo, and you know, but again, amazingly, all in good humor.
After the war, many of these men returned home and formed brass bands, which would perform in local halls and gazebos. American music was finally moving out of the home and becoming a social event for communities to share. This is the musical culture that Sousa emerges from, one in which brass and, to a lesser extent, wind instruments were a part of everyday life.
Lots of towns would have, you know, an amateur ensemble. You'd have the town band or the amateur orchestra in town. But these are just people who have other jobs who would get together and they would do a handful of concerts a year.
This is Patrick Warfield, an associate professor of musicology at the University of Maryland and an expert on John Philip Sousa's career.
So the idea of having professional musicians that come to your small town, your medium-sized city, and do a big performance is a special treat. But it's also true that, you know, lots of organizations were doing this. You know, the Boston Symphony, after it was founded, does tours. Theater Thomas's orchestra does tours. So it wasn't unheard of, but it was, you had to kind of wait for it.
Sousa knew that there was a desire all over the country for the sort of polished performances the Marine Band put on. The Boston Symphony Orchestra, for example, had found success touring the States. So Sousa got permission from President Benjamin Harrison to take the band on tour. And this is a tradition, by the way, that continues to this day.
Thanks, Benjamin Harrison.
So with his successful run as director of the Marine Band, why would Sousa want to leave and branch out on his own?
He had so many duties that were required for him to do as part of the conductor of the Marine Band. And he did them very well. He did them for quite a long time when you think about it.
This is Mark Scatterday, conductor of the Eastman Wind Orchestra and the Eastman Wind Ensemble, which just so happened to be stationed in our hometown of Rochester, New York.
And I think a lot of times musicians come to a certain point where they say, okay, I'm ready for something else. For instance, rock musicians do the same thing. Like, for instance, if you think about a group like the Police or the Beatles, or a lot of those guys then went off on their own. I don't think he resented it. I just think he wanted to move on and have maybe more control over his destiny and his music.
Okay, but it wasn't just creative freedom he wanted. Leading the Marine Band is a government gig. Prestigious and dignified, maybe, but it was never going to make Sousa rich. The Marine Band's manager, David Blakely, wanted to put together an independent touring band and put Sousa at the helm. And this would, of course, mean that Sousa had to resign from the Marines. But it was all going to be worth it.
There's the promise of making a great deal of money. And so for Sousa, it's a huge turning point. It's going from making $1,500 more or less per year to his contract with Blakely after 1892 is $6,000 a year plus 10% of the profits in the first year, 20% after that. It's a lot more money. He's going to be a millionaire within a few years. So the change for him is huge.
During the summer of 1892, experiencing a sort of newfound independence, Sousa and Blakely gathered the best musicians they could find from all over the country and from Europe to form what they called Sousa's New Marine Band. One source claimed that more than 500 musicians applied for just 50 positions in the band.
This is a pretty gutsy move, calling a band of civilians the New Marine Band. But you should keep in mind, at that point, Sousa wasn't a household name yet, and the association with Marines is the kind of thing that would give his ensemble a sort of instant, prepackaged prestige and draw crowds to his shows. Here's Jim Davis.
Without ever coming out and saying he's a military band, he's in a sense capitalizing on the public's assumption. And with all the veterans and a positive view of the military at the time, he is by default presenting himself, his band, and their music as ethical, wholesome, American.
By September 1892, Sousa's New Marine Band was ready for its debut. Again, Patrick Warfield.
The Sousa Band's main event was the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago of 1892-1893. And they've just been formed. And the thing you really do not want to do if you're Sousa and David Blakely is take your brand new band and put it at the World's Columbian Exposition, the highest profile gig in the world, on their first outing. And what you want is to sort of rev up to that.
So why choose Plainfield, New Jersey for the first concert?
Plainfield is not far from New York City. A lot of very wealthy people in finance from New York vacation there. So they're well-sophisticated people. But it's also not a place where you have the New York press or the Chicago press. It's really going to be nitpicky and come attack a brand new ensemble. So he gets a bunch of really good reviews before they even arrive in Chicago.
The program for the first concert, which was at Stillman Music Hall on Front Street, which is no longer there, by the way, was a mix of Sousa's own compositions and classical pieces. So if you're a member of this audience...
I can hear music that I know I should like, and I probably do, and I will hear music that I know I like and that's really fun. He's not going to play the most outrageously difficult music for audiences, but it's more like the Hooked on Classics albums, where it's It's all the music that you sort of vaguely know from classical music, the things that are sort of familiar and you sort of like, and you skip all the parts that you're not going to like because they're too long and boring, and that's a Sousa concert.
And indeed, in this first concert, Sousa, always the entertainer, included more than one spectacle. In the performance of his new March of the Trumpets, Sousa added six Egyptian trumpets, each 5 feet long, just for the occasion. And the trumpeters would, according to a newspaper, come down to the footlights and point their long trumpets up to the chandelier and make things rattle.
The penultimate number was one Sousa called Goodbye. It was a mashup of many songs. The Soldier's Farewell, Goodbye Sweetheart, How Can I Leave Thee, We're Going Home to Dixie, Last Rose of Summer.
I'm sensing a theme.
Goodbye, Bye-bye My Honey, I'm Gone, Then You'll Remember Me. As each segment ended, its principal performers left the stage until finally Sousa was left alone. Then, a single performer came back into view, playing Annie Laurie, and as soon as the... Then, a single performer came back into view, playing Annie Laurie, and soon the entire band was reassembling on stage, coming in from every direction.
From this first concert, in fact, even before they set foot on stage, Sousa's band promised to change the face of American music. In his promotions of the band ahead of the first show, Blakely claimed Sousa's new band would, quote, constitute an absolute revelation to the American people of the possibilities of this popular branch of musical art, and they will go away from its concerts wondering how such varied, stirring, and beautiful effects can possibly be produced by a military band.
From all accounts, he was right. As the newspaper reported the day after the debut concert,
altogether, the audience was delighted, and Sousa and his band were delighted that they had succeeded so well in delighting them, and the entertainment will be long remembered.
This concert, on September 26, 1892, and the ensuing tour that culminated in the 38-day stint at the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago, marked the beginning of 40 years of sustained musical superstardom for John Philip Sousa. This wasn't exactly a solo career, of course. The size of his band ranged from 40 to 60 professional wind musicians and percussionists, the very best in the world, for all those years. But it was always Sousa's band, not anyone else's. He was its burly, bearded, and very charming center of gravity.
Between about 1892, the year you're talking about, and around World War I or so, Sousa was amongst the most famous celebrities in the world, and certainly among the most famous Americans.
Because he could draw massive audiences wherever he went, because his concerts were these elaborately produced musical spectacles that were still accessible to anyone, Sousa helped bridge the divide between what we'd now think of as high and low music. That is, between sophisticated classical music and opera on one hand, and everyday American popular music on the other.
This ensemble would be playing a folk song followed by an opera aria.
Again, Jim Davis.
This, and I use air quotes, uneducated audience is consuming some of the highbrow music alongside the lowbrow music. There's no division for them. It's great music, and they're enjoying it. This gives the band a leg up on any other ensemble in the country at the time, because orchestras are playing their stuff, opera's opera, the minstrel show is dying, and here's the band that will basically give you whatever you want whenever you want it. And Americans love that.
Even though he clearly wanted to break down the boundaries between audiences and art, Sousa didn't see himself as an educator, as someone who was trying to force audiences to think. He was a consummate showman who fed off the energy of the audience. He wanted to get people tapping their toes, cheering, clapping to the beat, shouting out for encores of the hits. This was music that was participatory, not passive. This was music that was supposed to be fun, not functional.
People don't come to concerts to admire how difficult music is. They come to be entertained, you see? Some people come and they like to learn some things too, but basically we're all entertainers. You know, we're artists, we're musicians, but we're also entertainers.
Chuck Klosterman, the great rock critic, wrote in the New York Times last year that, quote, John Philip Sousa is the most successful American musician of all time. With everything that's happened in popular music since this first concert, like the rise of blues, jazz, rock, pop, and hip-hop, it sounds a little crazy to say that no band in American history has been as prolific or as popular for as long as Sousa's band. But it's not.
The sheer scale of the Sousa Band's career is unparalleled. More than 15,000 concerts over four decades, 1.3 million miles traveled by rail, millions of audience members during Sousa's lifetime, and millions more since.
Basically, Sousa did create the American march in a way. I mean, he wasn't the first, but he was the best. And you look back at this and you think, oh my God, this is so simple. Well, you know, why didn't everybody do this? With every invention, Thomas Edison, you name it, it just seems so simple. And that's what makes a great, I think, somebody really great and immortal in history.
Today, Then, is produced by Eitan Friedenberg, Molly Tarbell, and Stephen Ressner. Stay tuned for the next full episode of Today, Then, on Halloween. Ooh. October 31st, and episodes of Briefly are mini podcasts every Tuesday. If you find yourself on our iTunes page, leave us a review. And don't forget to cast a vote for us for Best Local Podcast at rochestercitynewspaper.com. As always, you can head over to our Twitter and Facebook pages for regular updates. We would like to thank our interviewees for their generosity and invaluable input. Thank you to Jim Davis at the State University of New York at Fredonia, to Patrick Warfield at the University of Maryland, and Mark Scatterday at the Eastman School of Music, right here in Rochester, New York. This episode featured music by John Philip Sousa. Check him out on the web. Our theme music is composed by Small Signals. Thank you for listening.